You're killing me, Larry!
Larry. Fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
Come on, Larry. Larry. Larry.
You know, if you kept a journal of your life and decided to turn it into a book, you could only determine the chapter breaks in retrospect. Most life-changing events and decisions kind of sneak up on us, don't they? Sure, some can happen in an instant, but mostly they happen gradually. It's no secret that for some time now I've been getting ready to flee Los Angeles, which is something I never thought I'd be doing. Because when I came to L.A., I was fleeing the city of New York, where I was born and raised. As a kid, I was never much of a baseball fan, but people there demanded that everyone had to choose a team, either Yankees or Mets. The Yankees were up in the Bronx, in one of the most dangerous areas of the city. You literally took your life in your hands hanging around that neighborhood. And even if you survived, the place was depressing as hell, surrounded by burned-out tenements. Instead of demolishing the crack houses, the imbecile politicians paid some contractor millions to cover all the broken and burned out windows with sheet metal painted to look like a window shade, complete with the ring and a string. That pretty much summed up New York back then, and it seems still does. Don't fix problems, just cover them up. In all the years I lived in New York, I visited that house that Ruth built only once and left when I found myself seated in the middle of a brawl. The place was an absolute shit show. I chronicled that nutty experience in episode 24, The Three Keys to a Great Life. You can find that under the May 2017 tab at thatlarryshow.com. And besides the brawl, there actually are three keys, and they are the truth. The Mets were kind of a joke in their early years, but at least their stadium wasn't in a high-crime area. The Mets' colors, however, could make a pig puke. Blue and orange. Who decided on those? When people asked me what ball club I liked, I always, and I mean from like first grade, I answered, the Dodgers. I didn't give a shit how they played or who was on their team. I didn't particularly like baseball, but I liked the Dodgers because they had escaped New York. They left behind the cold and gray and grime and crime for sunshine and palm trees and movie stars and impossibly hot-looking women. They even had a cool name, born of the Trolley Dodgers in Old Brooklyn. It beat the ass off the Yankees. Nobody can agree on the etymology of that name, but it sounds fucking stupid, like either a parasitic skin disorder or a club for chronic masturbators. The Mets had an equally lame name, the Metropolitans. Anything cool or fun or bold or fast or athletic about that? Growing up in New York, I always had this gnawing feeling that somewhere life had to be better, easier, more beautiful. L.A. was, to me at least, the promised land. Land of milk and honey, of limitless opportunity, of untapped potential and fisheye horizons. Of course, New York wasn't all bad. There were plenty of beaches, but they varied in quality, same as those in Southern California. Some were fantastic, and for several years I lived at one of the best. It was a little place nobody's ever heard of, sandwiched between Lido Beach, made famous by the movie The Flamingo Kid, and the much more famous Jones Beach. Jones was a nice beach, but it had a fatal flaw. It was public. My town had the improbable name of Point Lookout. It was basically a sandbar south of the main part of Long Island. You had to cross five bridges to get there. But once you did, you We're in a time warp. Zero crime. No litter. No graffiti. Just maybe 100 or 2 neat, compact homes. The town had a little supermarket, a couple of bars, a church, a small marina, and a gorgeous beach. There was no mail delivery. You could pick up your mail at the post office on Main Street, which was maybe all of 3 blocks long. Every 4th of July, they had a parade on that Main Street. Kids would ride their bikes with flag pennants and baseball cards clothespinned to the wheels, and red, white, and blue streamers from the handlebars. It was Norman Rockwell's early 20th century America at the turn of the 21st century. What made it really great was it was all private. How'd they do that? Easy. No street parking. None. Ever. Throwing a party? Well, you better be pals with your neighbors so they'll let your guests park in their driveways. Otherwise, they'll be calling a cab to get home because any street park vehicle would be towed in a flash. Plus, in summer, you needed a beach badge to get on the beach, and you could not obtain one unless you were a resident. There are lots of private beaches on the East Coast, and not a single square inch of one along the 840-mile California coastline, which really pisses off people in Malibu, where they'll drop 30, 40, 60 million or more on a beach house. But any dirtbag or crackhead can loiter on the beach in front of that home whenever they please, and the owners, well, they just have to put up with it. Billionaire David Geffen had a shit fight some years back. He had one of those Malibu mansions and tried to restrict public access to the beach in front of his palace. Well, the People's Republic of California landed on him with enough lawyers to crush an I-beam. My little town was way, way better than Malibu. There were no $50 million mansions, but it was exclusive, not the least bit inclusive, which no doubt pissed off the inclusivity cheerleaders. But they're all full of shit, aren't they? They demand access to everyone else's places and things, but just try asking if you can use their car or their home or have their job or some of their money. Watch how they sputter and stammer then. The beach at Point Lookout was a few hundred yards of heaven, and the asshole factor was pretty much zero. There was a jetty I would fish from, and after a while, I discovered a hole that was damn near a sure thing. A hunk of squid on a hook, and in a half dozen casts, I'd have a fluke or sea bass or oyster cracker. Fish so fresh they were still flapping when I filleted them. In winter, I'd sauté them French style, lemon and butter in a cast iron skillet, and in summer, I'd grill them on that fantastic flagstone patio. Eat dinner as I watched the girls go by and the fishing boats heading home and the sun setting. It was idyllic. From my house, I could also see the Manhattan skyline. It was only about 20 miles as the crow flew. I'd look at the skyscrapers and laugh. The people I worked with at my Manhattan office thought I was crazy for living where I did, like some weirdo, hillbilly, unibomber, hermit or something. Why would I endure a daily round-trip commute of 3 hours? How could I miss out on all the glories of Manhattan? Ooh, Broadway, the restaurants, the museums, the culture, the crackle of big city living. Well, I had all that shit from 9 to 5, 5 days a week. Then I went home to my 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage, private beach paradise. They went home to their 400-square-foot, 5th-floor walk-up studio apartments, where they could smell what their neighbors were having for dinner, hear their toilets flush, know what TV shows they watched, if they had a cough, a domestic battle, or snored. And for their glorious shoebox apartment, they were paying 3 to 4 times the rent that I was. Technically, my town was part of Long Island, but geographically, I guess even some way sociologically, it was not. Long Island is a 120-mile-long finger of land that had amazing variety. There were towns where you could get dead pretty quick, and other towns so high-end and exclusive, only the hedge fund managers who lived there knew they existed. For some reason, many of those were on the North Shore, which fronted not the ocean, but Long Island Sound, a long inlet of the ocean between Connecticut and Long Island. On the North Shore were massive, sprawling estates of many, many acres, often on the waterfront with stone walls and armed guards and iron gates. The North Shore was where the Great Gatsby lived, a fictional four-flusher, a character inspired by many real-life four-flushers. My little slice of heaven was on the South Shore on the roiling, foaming Atlantic Ocean. I always preferred the South Shore to the North. The South Shore tended to be far less pretentious. It was where clam diggers would mix with multimillionaires and everybody got along pretty good. On the North Shore, they wanted to see your papers or your pedigree. One of those towns on the north side was called Locust Valley, which spawned the pejorative Locust Valley Lockjaw. You've probably heard that patois in tons of movies, right? Some ascot-wearing fool asking Muffy and Buffy if the martinis are ready. It's kind of a rich wasp trope. In college, I went on a date with a girl who lived in Locust Valley. The uniformed dude at the guardhouse smiled and told me I was expected. When I continued to her home to pick her up, I was drop-jawed. The driveway must have been a half a mile. I wondered if her old man ran a Mercedes dealership from the mansion. I counted 8 gleaming Benzes, including a gullwing, before I rang the doorbell. The 8-car garage doors were closed. Who knows what treasures waited behind those? A uniformed maid answered. She was very nice. In a minute or two, my date came down the curved staircase. We had a nice evening, but as Steve McQueen famously said, there were no bells and banjos. The Atlantic is very different from the Pacific. For one, it's a hell of a lot saltier, which makes swimming and floating easier. The Atlantic coast is also a sawtoothed arrangement, which makes it more amenable to dockage and marinas and sea life. You can smell the Atlantic from miles away. All those coves and bays and estuaries, they're perfect hatcheries for all kinds of creatures. The Pacific coast is mostly razor cut. The only way you know you've arrived at the beach is by the sound and the sight. It's almost odorless. On that count, I give preference to the Atlantic. I don't recall exactly how I discovered Point Lookout or lucked into that fantastic rental. The owner had made a ton of money in the textile business. He had several houses and spent most of his time in Palm Beach, Florida. The home I was about to rent was beautiful, filled with antiques, and right on the beach. It looked out on the crashing surf. Besides that big flagstone patio on the side, where I held dozens of barbecues, there was a deck above the garage, perfect for sunbathing or gazing at stars at night. It was fantastic. The landlord and I became good friends. He was around 70, but looked and acted far younger. When I met him, it was a Saturday morning. He was out front trimming the rose bushes with big shears. It was a gorgeous, sunny day in early May. Blue skies and puffy whites with a constant sea breeze. At his feet was a big tumbler full of an amber liquid. 8 or 10 ounces, at least I assumed it was iced tea. I soon learned it was a blended scotch branded Vat 69. He chugged it as if it was iced tea and evinced no effects whatsoever. None. He'd rented the house previously with disastrous results. Busted furniture, later unpaid rent, that kind of thing. His wife was a living doll, could not have been any sweeter. She insisted I join them for lunch on the patio. Well, lunch turned into dinner. I felt as if I was with an aunt, an uncle. They were like family cool. Over dinner, Al told a dozen stories, each one successively funnier and more fascinating. Then he named a ridiculously low price for the monthly rent. I asked if he wasn't mistaken. He said if I paid a penny more, he'd be insulted. So we shook hands and had a deal. He told me there were a couple of girls who lived down the street and they'd probably be eager to meet me. Their names were Rose and Prudence. My mind instantly formed images of hot, pointy, kinky British chicks who'd either fight over my attention or join forces and make me their plaything. I snapped out of my reverie and noticed Al was staring at me with a half-smile, a sardonic look on his face. Then he delivered the punchline. He said, "Rose and Prudence are about 90 each." His wife rolled her eyes. Then he gave me a more detailed tour of the place, showed me how to start the oil burner if it quit, advised me to order a cord of wood because of the power failures. Then he got pretty serious and told me that as nice as things are right here and now in May, by mid-January, I might want to blow my brains out. The sky would be gray for weeks on end. The place would be nearly deserted when all the summer people had left. He said, "So if you're not okay with keeping your own company, you might want to reconsider the lease." I felt a little bit like Nicholson in The Shining. Of course, I leased the house and found that Al did not bullshit. Several times a year, some commercial fishermen, drunk as skunks, would head for port late at night. They'd forget to reel in their nets and sever the power lines on the ocean floor. The blackouts usually lasted for 2 or 3 days, and during that time, I used candles and oil lamps and burned dozens of logs in this enormous fireplace. I learned a lot of lessons in my time there, like no matter how many logs you pile on a fire, if you stop feeding it, in about 3 hours, it's stone cold dead. When the blackouts would hit, I'd sit in a giant leather wingback chair in front of that fire. I'd play guitar or read books I'd somehow overlooked. The wind would be howling, the surf would be crashing, but I had plenty of food and firewood and an almost new big-ass V8 Mercury Grand Marquis in the driveway, just in case I needed to evacuate for some reason. That thing was built like a tank but rode like a cloud. It was snow white, with every option. It was like a rolling avalanche with chrome accents. I've owned a lot of cars, but that might have been my favorite. It was only about a year old when I bought it, less than 10,000 on the clock. Still had the new car smell, and it was tight. Yet, after a storm at that beach, I would find sand, not only in the interior, but inside the glove box. That's how hard the wind blew. I really did enjoy living there, but one evening, in the winter of year 3, I was driving home, well after midnight, from the train station in that marvelous Mercury. I'd been in Manhattan entertaining clients at dinner, and then some stupid, forgettable Broadway show. It was sleeting. There was black ice everywhere. As I crossed one of the 5 bridges, I hit an icy patch and foolishly tapped the brakes. The car did a complete 360 on that bridge, and somehow he regained control. At that moment, I wondered if I might meet the same fate as my paternal grandfather, whose Buick spun off a similar bridge and became his coffin. When I arrived at the house, there was another patch of black ice in the driveway, but hidden beneath a dusting of snow. I went into another slide and was sure I'd crash through the garage door. Fortunately, there was a hard-packed drift of snow in front of it. Stopped the car. I took a deep breath. 2 calamities missed in a matter of minutes. I just wanted to get inside, go to bed. I exited the car and walked to the front door. Another patch of black ice left me sprawled on the ground after a Chaplin-style pratfall. Inside, I lay in my bed looking out the bay window at the sea and the stars. Maybe Al was right. I wasn't about to blow my head off, but as nice as this place was, I'd had enough of isolation, enough of 3-hour commutes, most of all, enough of winter and the entire New York thing, my job, all of it. I wanted a change, a big, big change. I was lucky I hadn't slipped off that icy bridge or cracked my skull open in the fall on the doorstep. I actually said out loud to myself, I will never spend another winter in the Northeast as long as I fucking live. By June, I had a job in Los Angeles. I stood on the sidewalk in the western San Fernando Valley, watching a gigantic moving van unloaded by a couple of big dudes. They lugged my few belongings into the corporate apartment the company had rented for me. The building was gray. There were a couple of palm trees, but they looked sickly and drooped. Across the street was a mobile station. Across from that was a sea of cars in the parking lot of a massive mall. The blistering temperature distorted the air. It shimmered off their rooftops. That heat was unlike anything I'd felt in my life. There was a digital thermometer on the side of a bank, and it said 112. Like being in an oven. The apartment was okay, but shit compared to my place at the beach. Like the suckers I mocked in their Manhattan hovels, I would soon know what my neighbors had for dinner, hear their toilets flush, and know if they were screwing or fighting. Last to come off that van was my beloved Mercury automobile. The driver backed it down the ramps, then handed me the keys and a pen to sign some paperwork. He mopped the sweat from his brow and said, "Well, have you had enough of California yet?" I was sick. Sure, I'd felt isolated out there on the beach in New York, but I had some good friends I loved and could depend on if shit went south. Now here I stood in a strange place where I knew almost no one. I wanted to just jump in that car and drive east until I hit the Atlantic. I thought I'd made the biggest mistake of my life. That was a long time ago. It was rough for the first couple years. Eventually, I found my footing, bought a nice home, met my beautiful wife, started a family. My two little girls, whom I used to call my bodyguards, are now grown young ladies and are fiercely protective of me. Last weekend, they proved their abilities with handguns at the range. Accurate shots and unfazed by the recoil of higher calibers. Just amazing. What happened to my beloved Los Angeles? In a word, commies. Scumbag leftist politicians have destroyed the cities and much of the state. These are not just people with opposing political beliefs. These are garbage people. Evil human junk that should be packed into a rocket and shot into the sun. Hey, thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Follow the show between episodes on Facebook, No Agenda Social, and now that Musk bought it, take another look at Twitter. Seems he's spraying the commie cockroaches that have been censoring that platform for years. Just plug That Larry Show into the search bar and you'll find it. There are also direct links on the homepage. You can find hundreds more episodes at that homepage, thatlarryshow.com. While you're there, click the subscribe button so you never miss a show. If you like what you just heard, you can help me keep the lights on while I fight commies. Click the Patreon or PayPal buttons or donate through the post office box. That address is also on the show page. Thanks to the gibbering, cowardly commie imbecile I call Joey, times are pretty tough. So if you're cash strapped but still want to help out, leave a 5-star review wherever you download and tell your friends about the show and send them a link. If you want to write, the address is thatlarryshow@gmail.com. My friends, as Bobby Burns first said and Steinbeck borrowed, the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. That same sentiment was expressed more vividly by some soldier, no one sure who. And what he said was, no plan survives contact with the enemy. The only constant enemy is the unknown. No matter how carefully we try to configure our lives, fate will sometimes flip things sideways. Those who stay flexible and strong usually ride out the storm. Who knows? You might just wash up on some tropical paradise. I'll see you next Wednesday or thereabouts, and until that time, take no shit.